into the Civil War and segregation and things like that. I believe the roommate said that they had believed he had been planning something like this, quote, something like this, for 6 months. The photo that has emerged that has been, quite prominent, I know it's in the New York Times, is the photo of him wearing a jacket with the apartheid South African flag and the Rhodesian flag, that was the apartheid country that was in what is now called Zimbabwe, pinned to the jacket. So obviously he had, quite a racist education as well, picked a target that was highly political, was well aware that the pastor was a high-profile pastor, and gave a fairly political rationale, anger at, what he believed was the depredation to the black population in this country, and as he said, taking over our country, so, and raping our women, which are those are the things he said were motivating him. But nevertheless, I think it's important to put it in the context of the fact that this is part of a very long line of racist terror attacks against black people in this country that is a result of the deep-seated racism that really has existed originally because of slavery in this country and moving forward as part of the part and parcel of the bigotry that has also helped to keep black people subordinate status by and large.
So who benefits most from it being seen as a singular incident?
I think it's a great question. I mean, I think who benefits are the political elite and the economic elite, the 1%, all of these people. I mean, I think we can't abstract what happened from the context. By saying that, this is just one, lone wolf, perhaps quote-unquote crazy, perhaps quote-unquote deranged, then it makes the context not matter. It says Governor Nikki Haley, who ironically enough, when she was running for governor, she's a hard right Republican, but she's of Indian descent. When she was running for governor, she was actually the target of a number of racist attacks by some of these right-wing political figures inside of South Carolina. But, at the end of the day, I think what you see is that there are major news networks, political parties. I mean, just look at the Republican Party in this country that has made its stock in trade to gain partisan advantage in their quest to institute, a full free market fundamentalist Disneyland here in this country. That they've used a strategy that only has sort of a thinnest veneer covering it, but just about everyone knows that it's deeply racist, deeply anti-Muslim, and also with quite a bit of anti-immigrant rhetoric. So this is one of the most major political parties with access to very rich donors, who have access to very big-time media, who, are whipping up this unbelievable climate and context of racism. In the context, of course, of the racism going back 500 years and the long-term terrorism against blacks, lynchings, church bombings, assassinations, and so on and so forth. And I think you also have, and I don't think, they're equally as complicit, but certainly the Democratic Party that, refuses to challenge these things on anything but the lowest common denominator. Even when they challenge Republican proposals, they don't talk about how deeply seated they are in the racism in this country, how destructive they are. And so you don't have an honest discussion about what's really happening in this country, which is at the highest level, the most destructive attitudes being promoted. But if we abstract this out to just being a lone wolf person, then what you have is all of that context gets lost. And all of the people who are whipping up the hatred for not aggressively enough calling out the hatred for exactly what it is at the highest level, who are allowing this context in which this violence takes place, are allowed off the hook. And I think that's just as important to recognize that context creates reactions. And that certainly, that's your benefits, and that's who we have to make sure doesn't get off the hook. The rich and the powerful who stand behind this political system that from its highest levels promote this sort of just destructive racial division.
Mm. And can you tell us something about the political situation in South Carolina right now?
Yeah, I mean, the political situation in South Carolina, excuse me, let me drink the water. The political situation in South Carolina, as I alluded to, is, hard right, Tea Party, You had Nikki Haley when she was running for governor, one of the more a prominent official in the state legislature, was on a prominent radio show and was, you know, excoriating her, and actually uses an anti-Arab slur. Very bad one that I don't want to repeat on air, and is not only unapologetic, but, you know, essentially is like, well, you know, it wasn't offensive. This is a state where state legislators have, you know, routinely and openly engaged in not just Confederate reenactment from a historical perspective, but there was a photo that came out a few years ago of a state senator from South Carolina at the Confederate themed party where there were black people dressed up as slaves. And the picture of him with the smiling actors dressed up as slaves. You know, a state that has the Confederate flag flying over the state capitol. I mean, that's really, you know, the direct context. This is a state that's sort of in the very heart of this right-wing two-party movement that pushes this kind of aggressive hatred and bigotry. And I think it's important that that particular context also be known and consistent.
And can you speak to us about the historic nature of this church?
Absolutely. So this church, Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, the AME Church, is extremely historic. It's the oldest AME church in the southern part of the United States. It's a very old congregation. It was founded by a number of people. It's actually when it was still the Methodist Episcopal Church, I believe. And I'll say more about the AME Church later on. One of the founders was Denmark Vesey. So there's a number of individuals who are very prominent, very prominent in the history of black people in this country. Denmark Vesey, of course, the great slave revolt leader. Of course, the slave revolt he had planned in Charleston, South Carolina, was betrayed and never was carried off. We can talk more about that. You also had Daniel Alexander Payne, who was one of the most prominent AME bishops, also involved in Emmanuel AME. And, of course, through the years, the civil rights movement, based in some senses, not based out of, but very participatory in the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King's work there, I believe, in 1962. And on up into today, I mean, the current pastor was killed, was a state senator, was a prominent political figure. So this is a very prominent church inside of Charleston, very old, historic congregation. A lot of connections to the important history of blacks in South Carolina, the history of resistance in blacks in South Carolina, a church that's been targeted before by terrorism because of what they were willing to do and the risks they were willing to take. And in fact, Coretta Scott King led a march there in 1969 in support of the striking hospital workers in Charleston with the 1199 Union, which was a very historic fight that combined civil rights and the workers' rights fight in a similar way to the Memphis garbage workers and was led by SCLC and others like that. So, you know, at the end of the day, we see the Emmanuel AME Church as really having quite a bit of political and social significance for African Americans. And the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, started by the right Reverend Richard Allen and others in 1816 in Philadelphia. They had left the traditional Methodist Church because of racial discrimination and started their own church. And the AME Church has really been through the years. You know, my father was an AME minister. His father was an AME minister. So it's a long and deep history as one of the most independent institutions and one of the first independent institutions or relatively independent of black people in America. And so not only with this particular church, but in fact, the entire denomination of the AME Church has a lot of significance from a political point of view and from a standing point of view in the black community.
Can you tell us more about Denmark Vesey and his slave revolts?
Of course. Denmark Vesey was the leader of a slave revolt. He's a preacher now in Charleston. And so because of his religious duties, he was able to have wide contact with all sections, actually, of the black population, but certainly amongst the slaves, and was able to organize in 1822 what would have been a very wide-ranging revolt. And notably enough, of course, South Carolina is also the home of the 1730 revolt, the Stono Rebellion. That was also one of the largest slave rebellions that took place. But nevertheless, this plot in 1822 allegedly involved thousands and thousands of slaves, hundreds of people were originally, or at the end of the day, ended up being arrested and many of them punished, and including Mr. VC were hung. And quite frankly, it was one of the more bellwether rebellions that has existed in the history because of, even though it wasn't carried off, the wide-ranging scope of the thing and how big it would have been and how well organized it was, given that, other than the fact that, of course, it was betrayed by some individuals who, you know, were afraid to challenge slavery. Certainly it was extremely well organized. Many thousands of people were involved, and certainly it was not just slaves. It was also some free blacks like Denmark Vesey, and his name, because of this, became really quite major. In fact, Frederick Douglass, when he was recruiting for the American Civil War for black troops, would often use Vesey's name to recruit. And so, quite frankly, a church that was founded by him, at least in part, certainly has this spirit of resistance deep in its core. And I think that the history of this revolt should be further known.
And, you know, what should the reaction be from the Black Lives Matter movement around this incident?
Well, I think that the Black Lives Matter movement should look at this incident for what it is, and I think should be the vessel to help others understand what this really is. And, you know, to their credit, I see that even the New York Times has an article this morning about the attacks on black congregations in Charleston before. But we have to recognize that this, the terrorism against black churches, as oftentimes some of the only independent institutions inside of the African-American community, is very significant and happens all the time. There's a long history of it. In the mid-90s, there's a long rash of church bombings and burnings that people may remember. In fact, a good family friend of mine, their church in Buckingham County was burned to the ground by some of these racist forces. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement should be the first to say that this is not an isolated incident, really. It's a result of racism, all the things I was saying in some of the earlier questions, and to help frame it for the country and to be that strategic vessel that helps fight back and hold accountable people who deserve to be held accountable, and the system that deserves to be held accountable, not just allow folks to walk away and define it at an elite level as a lone wolf attack. And I think that's an important role that Black Lives Matter groups can play and have the ability to help in some way at least shape the narrative.
So what do you make of President Obama's comments?
Well, I think the president's comments were, I mean, they were what they were. I mean, obviously, he had a personal connection to the church. The church very involved politically, so he knew the pastor. He knew some, I believe he actually had at least met some of the individuals who were killed. So obviously, the personal comments he made certainly rung true. I thought that the fact that he tried to point out gun control was, obviously it makes sense why, but certainly it sort of speaks to the reality of why sort of the Faustian bargain that the first black president had to really make to even become president, which was quite frankly not to be too black and not to raise too many black issues. And for the president, who quite frankly has been the target of a significant amount of this hatred I'm talking about that's been kicked up by many of these people at the elite level, to not call that out, I think, is unfortunate. But I think it's not surprising because I think it speaks to the core of his presidency, which is one that was more than willing to compromise on how aggressively it was going to push black issues in order to allow a black president to gain the assent of a number of individuals who still have some sort of racist feeling about African Americans, whereby they feel that appealing explicitly to the problems that affect us in a way that is, more or less unique, or at least disproportionate in terms of, say, housing or jobs or something like that, they think that that's favoritism as opposed to just the intelligent way to deal with the social problems of the country. So I think it's unfortunate, but I think at the end of the day, it's indicative of the role that the president has played and the role that he was more or less destined to play from the beginning.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details.
He was listening to voices talking in his head. If you grew up in America, you know exactly what they said. And with every job we lose, however bad things get, there's a black man in the White House on the TV set. And we can blame it all on him and his entire race, because they no longer know their place. You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the State House lawn. He was listening to voices. You could say that he was crazy for thinking certain people are just born to be lazy. He could see it on the cop shows. They don't know right from wrong. The race war is coming, and now it won't be long. I promise it was not his original notion. If you want to start a war, first you have to set the war in motion. You can hear the voices by the early light of dawn. You can see the flag waving on the State House lawn.
Rounding out the newscast for this evening, KBOO News In Depth, that's David Rovics doing On the State House Lawn. It is 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland.